Gordon, Kenneth Mall follows the phenomenal rise of the dancing partnership of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and the worldwide boom in ballroom dancing that followed it. Of how George Gershwin composed America's first folk opera, Porgy and Bess. While in Britain, our own George Formby was beginning to sell records in a big way.
A lot of things happened to the world in 1934 that had profound effects on the history of the next few years. But the chances are that if you were to ask a songwriter the most significant event of that year, he would say something about a most unpredictable organization called the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. This was a little piece of machinery designed by Hollywood for the purpose of patting its inventors on the back. Now, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences had been doling out prizes, or Academy Awards, as they were called, for some years. Best film, best actor, best actress, best director, and so forth. And in 1934, for the first time, there was included in the list an award for the best original song written for a motion picture. And this was the winner.
The Continental, because it does what you wanted to do. It has a passion, the Continental, an invitation to moonlight and romance. It's quite the fashion, the Continental, because you tell of your love while you dance.
Your lips whisper so tenderly, her eyes answer your song.
Two bodies swaying, the Continental. And you are saying to what you're thinking of. So keep on dancing, the Continental. For it's a song of romance and of love.
You kiss while you're dancing. You sing while you're dancing. You'll know before the dance is through that you're in love with her and she's in love with you. You'll find while you're dancing
that there's a rhythm in your heart and soul, a certain rhythm that you can't control, and you will do the Continental all the time.
Continental, played by Lou Stone and his band, featuring the voice of Nat Gonella. Now, there's something very typical about that song. Notice that its lyric is all about dancing, and that was becoming a regular habit with the songs of the movies. As the 1930s moved on, more and more of the great songwriters were to write this type of song. Kern wrote I Won't Dance, Gershwin did Shall We Dance, while Irving Berlin wrote a whole set of songs to do with the art of stepping lively. And most of this repertoire can be traced back to one man, Fred Astaire. although it wasn't until 1935 that the film company RKO Radio realized that in Astaire and his new partner Ginger Rogers, they had the greatest box office bonanza potential in movie history. Once the bandwagon started to move, there was no stopping it. But as usual, the creators of this bandwagon hardly realized what was taking hold of them. And that goes for the composer Irving Berlin, as well as Astaire himself. Indeed, Berlin was so despondent that he sounds more like a critic than a musician.
I've seen several of my pictures previewed where I thought they were terrible. You take Top Hat, which was one of the biggest successes I had. We went to Santa Barbara to preview it, and I thought that the thing was a complete flop. But that was the wrong audience for that particular picture at that time. Then we went to another house, and of course, it showed us what we really had. And after it opened, then we knew what we had. So it's very hard to tell.
I just got an invitation through the mail. Your presence requested this evening is formal. The top hat, a white tie, a sail. Nothing now could take the wind out of my sail. Because I'm invited to step out this evening with top hat, white tie, and sail. So I'm putting on my top hat, tying up a white tie, brushing off my tail. I'm dooting up the shirt in front, putting in the shirt and dust, polishing my nails. I'm stepping out, my dear, to breathe an atmosphere that simply reeks with class. And I trust that you'll excuse my dust when I step on the gas. For I'll be there, putting down my top hat, mustering up the white tie, dancing in my tail.
Top Hat was the first of the vintage Astaire Rogers musicals, and it heralded a new age, not only at the box office, but also in the world at large. So it's not surprising that those involved in the making of this picture, like Fred Astaire, always retained a very special affection for it.
Oh, I thought it was a good picture. I think it's a kind of a standard. It doesn't really age very much, that picture. It certainly is escapist fare, and there's a lot of things happen in there that are just sort of timeless. It just seems to me that it's acceptable at all times, and that much I do appreciate about it. It's going to be shown for a long time. It's nice to have it hold up. I've always loved that movie.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak, but it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to go out fishing in a river or a creek, but I don't enjoy it half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Dance with me, I want my arm about you, the charm about you will carry me through to heaven. I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly see, and I seem to find the happiness I seek out together, dancing cheek to cheek.
One other thing that Top Hat did was to follow this new trend of songs about dancing. In a Fred Astaire movie, that was a natural enough thing to do, because the scriptwriters were constantly striving to contrive situations where the hero could break into a dance. Nobody will ever quite know how many dancing schools were opened because of Fred Astaire's performances, how many suburban Romeos enrolled for a series of six rumba lessons, how many dance halls were built, and how many social reformers deplored the frivolity of it all. But even if you're Fred Astaire, you can't get very far as a dancer without some music to go with it. And it's probably no coincidence that concurrently with the great boom in dancing, there came the great boom in touring orchestras, famous dance bands, one-night stands. When Franklin D. Roosevelt repealed Prohibition in 1933, one of the incidental effects of his move was to close down all the gin mills and speakeasies where jazz musicians had once thrived. And so the musicians moved into a new area, the ballrooms. And in 1935, the same year as Top Hat, America first heard the sound of the man soon to be known as the King of Swing, Benny Goodman. Helen Ward with the Benny Goodman Orchestra. When Goodman organized that band and went out on the road, the results astonished everyone, including Goodman, who within two or three years was a dollar millionaire, a film star, and a world celebrity. And it didn't take long for his rivals to start chasing him. One of the most learned of them was another clarinetist, Artie Shaw, who had a very clear idea of what the new era, the swing age, had to offer. That was very different from the old Paul Whiteman approach.
Whatever contribution I may have made musically, it really came down to the fact that in the so-called swing era at that time, swing music was regarded by most people as noisy, blatant, full of drum riffs and trumpet riffs and so on. And what I did was to show that you could use this so-called swing idiom and apply it to music that was accepted, like Jerome Kern, Porter, Gershwin, even Sigmund Romberg and Victor Herbert. So, you know, the idea of swinging a tune like, say, Yesterday's by Kern, or Man I Love, or Lover Come Back to Me, or Begin the Beginning, for that matter, that was a rather strange notion at that time.
Begin the Begin by the Artie Shaw Orchestra. Now then, what's a 1938 record like that doing in a 1935 edition like this? Well, the slip is deliberate, because it illustrates the power that the new touring dance bands had. They were, in fact, the new arbiters of public taste. When Cole Porter introduced Begin the Begin to Broadway audiences in a show called Jubilee, the year was indeed 1935, but the song disappeared from view, and Porter wrote it off. Not till 3 years later, when Artie Shaw, looking for a filler for the B-side of a new recording, chose Begin the Begin, did the song become the raving sensation of the age. What Broadway couldn't do, the big bands apparently could. No wonder that before long, you couldn't get into a motor accident on the highways of America without bumping into an orchestra coach. One of the competitors in this crazy race for fame was Bing Crosby's kid brother, Bob. One day, a group of musicians came to hear Crosby Minor singing with the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra and decided he was more or less human, as singers go, and propositioned him. Here's how the young singer remembers it.
Well, they came to hear me with the Dorsey Brothers, and they said, "Do you think you could lead a band?" And by this time, I was quite sure that as a singer, I was never going to make it. And I was getting tired of being compared to Brother Bing, and naturally, I couldn't sing as well as Bing, and knew that. So I said, I'd like to take a crack at it. And they said, well, we'll give you a trial. We're going to book the Roseland Ballroom. And you've got a night off. We'll book it on that night. And you come on over because we're looking for a leader, and we'll see if you can lead the band. At any rate, I showed up at Roseland Ballroom, and there was a band. And before the first set, I'll never forget, I looked up at Ray Baduke, the drummer, who, of course, was on the top tier. And I yelled at him, how do you lead a band? And he yelled back, you give two beats, and I'll change the tempo correctly. And it seemed to work pretty well. And we seemed to have a certain rapport between the boys in the band and myself. And we decided to see if we couldn't get some bookings. And Rockwell got interested in what we were doing, and Rockwell arranged for us to go on a tour. And by that time, we had really built up the band because we had found some other players, one of which was Bob Haggart, who really became, I think, the prime catalyst for the Bob Crosby Bobcats. He did most of the arranging. He did so many compositions and things for the Bobcats, writing songs like Big Noise from Winnetka, South Rampart Street Parade, Dogtown Blues, What's New, My Inspiration, Slow Mood. These are all Bobby Haggart's.
Spirited music, and very popular it was, too. But all this time, for some years before the great band boom of the mid-1930s, the best orchestras of this type in America had been comparatively neglected by the exploiters and entrepreneurs of the entertainment business. And the reason why they were neglected was, in a word, color. Being Negro orchestras, they weren't exploitable on a national scale. But that didn't mean they couldn't produce the best music. Every one of the successful band leaders of the day, from Goodman to Shaw to Crosby, all knew who the great master was. As usual, it's Artie Shaw who names names.
You're talking about men like Abe Lyman, Ben Burney, Irving Aronson, with whom I worked. These men weren't musicians. They weren't particularly interested. They pervade music. It's like a man who sells television sets. He's not an electronics man. He's not particularly interested in the quality of the set or what makes it work. They're not creators. They are simply purveyors. Well, there is always room for the entrepreneur, of course. The sad fact is when you get a so-called artist, a man who has undoubtedly creative abilities in his either playing or writing, and let's take the late Duke Ellington as a case in point. It's a rare combination of qualities required to have that man stand in front of a group of musicians and maintain an organization at the same time that he does not allow that to dampen too much his musical abilities.
Duke Ellington Orchestra playing the Ellington composition Solitude, the song that the American Society of Authors, Composers and Publishers awarded the prize for the best new song of 1934. Now perhaps the Astaire Rogers sensation and the big band sensation makes the period sound like a time of new talent. Well, that's only partly true. Some of the old timers were still insisting on behaving like young men. You remember Rudolf Rimmel, the sensation of 1912, the toast of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police for his success with Rosemarie? Well, by 1935, he was only just getting started. And so was a young singer and prospective father called Alan Jones, father of Jack.
Rudolf was a very excitable man, very temperamental, but a very humorous man. He had a marvelous sense of humor. Very warm person. And we needed a song in The Firefly, which I did with Jeanette, as I rode along on my horse along the coach that she was riding in the Pyrenees Mountains. And Herb Stothard was the musical conductor in charge of the music on the picture, and he had been Frimmel's conductor in New York on most of his shows. And he thought of this song that Frimmel had written 50 years prior to then, called Chansonette. And it was a slow waltz. Da-da-dee-da-da-da. So he changed the tempo and talked to Frimmel about it first. It became the Donkey Serenade. And I recorded that for RCA Victor about a year later. And my wife at the time was Irene Hervey, Jack's mother. And the day that I was to record, I was recording that night. She was going to have a natural birth in the house. When I finished, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I dashed home and ran upstairs just in time to see the doctor slap him on the behind and heard his first yell. And Jack, recently, in his nightclub act, he said, "You know, I was born the night my dad recorded the Donkey Serenade." So that's why they named me Jack.
There's a song in the air, but the fair senorita doesn't seem to care for the song in the air. So I sing to the mule, if you're sure she won't think that I am just a fool.
She not have a baby play.
Say, yes,
she listens carefully to each little tune you play.
Si, la bella signorita.
Si, si, mi muchachito. She'd love to sing it too if only she knew the way. But she may, in her voice there's a flaw. And all that the lady can say.
Alan Jones with Rudolph Frimmel's famous donkey. And talking of donkeys, that brings us to the movie tycoons, who by 1935 were well on in the campaign to make the whole world put on a bib and start making glugging noises. In 100 years' time, sociologists will look back and define the mid-30s as the Shirley Temple era. And sometimes the job of writing songs for the smallest big shot in the business had a peculiar effect, for instance, on Irving Caesar.
I wrote another wonderful song for Shirley Temple. Make my mummy's life, and as the only... Make my mummy's life, and as the only Christian Christmas song I know of, because it talks of giving, not receiving. Most Christmas songs are antithetical to the idea of Christmas. They're all selfish little songs about having a good time and wanting to get... Am I right? This one is in the spirit of crisis. Make my mummy's life a song. Let me have them all year long. Make my mummy's life a song. That's what I want for Christmas. Let my dolls be made of rags. Firemen hats of paper bags. Just like love on the Christmas tags. That's what I want for Christmas. When I wake up Christmas Day, I would like to find a sleigh. But if I don't, dear Santa Claus, I will not complain, because what I really want is this. Sister smile and brother's kiss. Fill our land with peace and bliss. From Maine down to the Isthmus. That's what I want for Christmas. That's the only real Christmas song, believe me, it is. But mine really has a moral, and little Shirley did it, you know. Go away, and I'm very proud of it. I don't plug it. I mean, I'm a very modest song publisher.
If that's a modest songwriter, I'd hate to meet a conceited one on a dark night. As a matter of fact, Blushing Violet Caesar wrote a much more famous song for Miss Temple around this time. It earned everybody a fortune, and after it, the soup industry was never quite the same again.
Animal crackers in my soup, monkeys and rabbits, loop-a-loop. Cash for tea, but I have a swallowing animal one by one. In every bowl of soup I see, lions and tigers watching me. I make them jump right to walk with those animal crackers in my soup. When I get hold of the big rabbit, I just push him under to the ground. Then I bite him in a million bits, and I go move him right down. When they're inside me, well and dark, I walk around like Noah's Ark. I suck my tummy like a goose when animal crackers in my soup.
Animal Crackers, one of the songs with which Shirley Temple conquered the world. But when everyone wasn't crying into the soup, what other songs were they singing around the 34-35 mark? Well, one song qualifies as one of the craziest of the decade. Now, if I said to you, I've decided to write a song that describes what goes on inside a trumpet, you'd probably ask me not to slam the door on my way out. But you'd be wrong. Now, you just listen to this.
Trumpet man, go to town. won't do it. Listen to jazz come out. Swing it, guitar, swing it.
Boswell Sisters going round and round. The kind of success that used to be euphemistically described as a novelty song. Something rather more orthodox, that had a tremendous vogue for a while, was an item written by the long since forgotten Pinky Tomlin, who was one of the earliest writers not to waste time looking for people to record his song, but record it himself.
The object of my affection can change my complexion from white to rosy red. Anytime she holds my hand and tells me that she's mine. There are many girls who can thrill me and some who can chill me, but I'll just hang around. Oh, and keep acting like a clown until she says she's mine. Now I'm not afraid that she'll leave me, not because she's not that kind who takes a dare. But instead I trust her implicitly. She can go where she wants to go, do what she wants to do, and I sure won't care. Cause the object of my affection can change my complexion from white to rosy red. Oh, anytime she holds my hand and tells me that she's mine. Oh, my.